Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Protests continue in Libya, where hundreds have died in rebellion against their longtime dictator, Muammar Gaddafi. How does this differ from change in Egypt and other places in the Middle East? And was this a long time coming or another domino to fall or teeter, as the case may be, in the Middle East? Joining us now is Ohio State University economics professor Hassan Ali. He's speaking to us by phone from Cairo, Egypt, where he is visiting family and friends. Welcome to the show, Hassan.
Thank you very much, Ann. Appreciate your having me on.
In a blog post from February 20th, you outlined the unrest and government actions in Libya and said that the question now is Libya going to catch up with its two neighbors, Tunisia and Egypt? What do you think now?
Well, I think it's inevitable. I think it will. It's definitely going on, especially with the international pressure now. But as you know, Gaddafi never been predictable, and people really don't know what's his next step. But all the circles is closing on him right now, so he must go for sure.
And yet he's made every indication that he will not go, and he's doing this in no small part by killing his own people, hundreds.
Correct. And that's adding to the fire, definitely. And you mentioned in the introduction something about Libya being different. The main difference that exists between Libya and Egypt, that tribal custom and habit still rule in Egypt. Just as if today, actually, the only two cities that consider to be calm in Libya are Sirte and Sabha, and those are the two cities where the tribe of Gaddafi's family reside in. So that's one of the things that if you look at the reflection on Libya that I have put in on the blog there, there is also a prediction that this might go for separation between the west part and the east part of Libya. This is now far-fetched. But it could happen, again, based on the tribal lines. So
if that occurred, if the country were split in two, the violence and the strife, would it continue then?
Oh, definitely. It's going to be a civil war. I mean, it's going to be like, India and Pakistan on each other's throat. Is going to be like North Korea and South Korea on each other's throat, and it's going to be a major. But now I think there is no qualm that he will go, because the international pressure is so much on him, and he has been exposed basically, and it's not going to be up to him or even up to the people in his tribe now. I think definitely it's going to be a long time, longer probably than the Egyptian or the Tunisian, but it's definitely going to lead to the ouster of this dictator.
My guest right now is Ohio State University economics professor Hassan Ali. He's speaking to us from Cairo, Egypt. If you have a question or comment, please get that in quickly. Hassan won't be with us for more than another 10 minutes or so. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're an economist, so this is right up your alley. Development in Libya, despite its wealth, its massive wealth in its way, is tepid. At best, everything revolves around oil. Efforts to bolster development, you've written, have been resisted by the old guards and beneficiaries of the current status. So who makes up that old guard, and why are they resisting further development?
Remember that the oil wealth is basically in the hands of this guy. He has the power to control it, distribute it, and do whatever he wants with it. And people who are around him will get much better, much bigger piece of the pie if he is around, and they don't want it to be redistributed equally among the all people of Libya, for that matter. And that's where the resistance come from. And also, they build their own centers of powers and economic powers and the like. See what's happening to his children. Every one of them is participating in the political life as well as the economic life. Every one of them owns a piece of a company or has his hand on something big in the army. So that's why they are resisting these changes.
But many are leaving now?
Of course, a lot of people are leaving.
But in terms of his supporters.
Actually, let me mention that the situation on the border, Libya has border with Egypt, has border with Tunisia, and also has border with Algeria. But the border with Tunisia specifically, which is the closest to Tripoli, where all the fights are coming are going on right now, the situation is very desperate. There are a lot of people in the cold there for days. They basically lack food, they lack medicine. And he is harassing the people on the border. I just heard tonight that he is sending a lot of his militia to hunt these people who are trying to leave.
What is the reception like in Egypt, where they've just undergone their own massive change? Are they equipped? Are they ready to help?
Of course, they have sent a lot of medical assistance and the like, but their hands is full. I'm six blocks away from the Tahrir Square, and I just passed by it. There's quite a few people in the square right now, sitting in, asking for the current prime minister to resign. And you know, things haven't settled in Egypt as well. So they are probably have a lot on their hand, but they are very happy to see this movement taking place in Libya, because this guy is just squandering the wealth of the country for 42 years now. He is basically doing a very miserable job as far as bettering the life of the Libyan and also the life of the neighbors. He could have done that. This has a lot of spillover effects to other countries. But his action, his as you have seen the interview with, I think, CNN, or maybe I remember I've seen Christiana Mumbour. I don't know which network she with right now, but he is denying that there is unrest in the streets.
Yeah, let's listen to that.
he said, my people love me.
Yeah, here
they
he
will,
is.
They will die to protect me.
Here he is speaking early on about the unrest.
They looted shops, they seized weapons, and that's because some groups who infiltrated our cities are giving those youth hallucination pills and are trying to involve them in those side battles against the police and an army.
I tell you got to have feelings for the interpreter.
Yes, I am sympathizing with him. But about this hallucination bill, the cutest comment I heard from the Libyan ambassador in the UN, I believe, who just resigned a couple of days ago, and he said, if you listen to Gaddafi and his children, you think that Libya is full of mountain of hallucination bills, because you need this much in order to motivate all of these people to go out in the street and do what they have done. So the guy is just not connected. He lies and he believes his own lies. That's what's going on right now.
My guest is OSU economics professor Hassan Ali. If you have a question or comment, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also phone us, 614-292-8513. We have an email from Jeff. He asks, should the U.S. give weapons to the anti-Qaddafi protesters, or what should the world do to help the Libyans win against Qaddafi?
I think the first thing is the trying to prevent Qaddafi from attacking his own cities, because there are rumors that he's planning to send jet fighters to attack Benghazi, the city that has started it all in the east. So if there is an international effort to prevent such action by closing the airspace or whatever they have done in the past with Iraq, I think that would
be a no-fly zone,
the first step in the right direction. But I, you know, if things goes on like that, and there is a lot of stories about people being killed by the hundreds, mm-hmm. and he is cleaning up the streets, and I hear people, an eyewitness actually coming from Libya said that there are some bodies that were dumped in the sea just to erase any trace of crimes against humanity. So he's aware of what is going on, and he's trying to clean up before he faces. And this should not continue on. I think if there is any sign that he is committing such atrocity, people will be damned if they don't intervene.
614-292-8513. If you want to get that call right now, my guest is Hassan Ali. He is an OSU economics professor. He's speaking to us from Cairo. Tell us about the distinctions you make in your blog regarding the differences. Well, you actually draw a lot of similarities between Libya and Egypt and Tunisia as far as its median age,
right,
and unemployment rates and that sort of thing. But what I saw from that chart that you had is the huge differences. The population is so much different. It's so much smaller and more spread out in Libya.
Correct. And that's why probably it's a little bit more difficult for these people to collect themselves and come in a million-man march like what happened in Egypt. You know, mm-hmm. Cairo has an 18 million people living in it by itself, so it was easy to mass this number of people. In Libya, I think it's harder, and it's so dispersed, the population, and isolated. And I assume that some of the people in Libya until now probably are still watching the Libyan TV. By the way, the Libyan TV, if you watch it, it's like a comic relief. They have song, they have dance, and every now and then the leader will come up and encourage the people to stop these rats in the streets who are taking hallucination pills. So I'm assuming that that's a major difference, the population. But also remember that a lot of the intellectual in Libya has left the country. This
long,
is another issue.
Long ago, right? Or recently?
I didn't hear you, Anne.
Was it long ago or recently they've left?
No, long ago. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that I know and colleagues in economics and psychology, and they are, some of them are in U.S. universities as well, and they are all over the world. But they left because, you know, they voted by their feet, as we say.
Mm-hmm.
As I have done, actually, myself in 1986, leaving Egypt for very much the same reasons. So that's what happened when you have this kind of dictatorship, corruption, and you feel helpless. And this guy was, as you have seen, you know, he demonstrated that he is insane. He is not coherent, and he can do whatever he thinks right. He, as I said, he's living in his own world.
There is, I've heard about pirate radio in Libya. Otherwise, how are people communicating with each other?
I think cell phone work, they come around the stoppage of some of the companies. Because we do hear people talking to international media from cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
They are still using, again, internet. I think if you have a satellite in Libya, they can do something with it in order to get around. And Twitter has invented this during the Egyptian Revolution, where you can actually call in by phone and put something in Twitter. So they communicate quite a bit, and more now there is coordination among the people inside Libya, and a lot of coordination from outside. I think that also helped quite a bit.
I'm going to take a call right now. We're talking with Hassan Ali, he's an OSU economics professor. Before you leave, I wanted to hear from Abdul in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Abdul.
Yeah, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Hassan.
I'm originally from Somalia, and it is my hope and pray that Libyan people do not end up the same way Somalian did. As a matter of fact, here, Gaddafi, the first time he spoke, he used Somalia. He reminded everyone the Somalian situation. He said, we don't want to end up like that. And I wondered if he's on drugs. He doesn't even remember what he said. My quick question is that, do you think, what will you think the country that I know sooner or later he has to fled the country? Do you have an idea where he will go? My second question is that, do you think Saudi Arabia will be next?
I don't think that the Saudi will host Gaddafi, because he had a major feud with the king a couple of years ago. It's a public feud, actually, where he insulted the king and the king returned back the insult. There is no lost love between these two. So I don't think Saudi Arabia is in the list. But this guy said that he's not going to get out of the country. And I believe him. This guy either killed or commit suicide. Probably the last resort, maybe he will go to one of the African countries, down in Chad or Niger or alike. If you take my guess, it's either killed by one of his aides or committing suicide when things get closer to his neck.
Okay. Thank you, Abdul, for your call. We have to take a break, and we have to say goodbye to Hassan Ali, OSU economics professor in Cairo. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're most welcome. Thank you, Anne, for having me.
We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and at 2 o'clock this afternoon, Talk of the Nation begins. Guest host Mary Louise Kelly looks at women in combat, along with NPR's Rachel Martin. That discussion at 2 on Talk of the Nation. Also on the program, Oscar winner Alan Arkin talks about his life improvised. Talk of the Nation from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from CTL Engineering, proud of its more than 80 years of service providing consulting engineering and laboratory testing services. More information online at ctleng.com.
35 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 45 degrees. Clear skies tonight, a low of 29. More sunshine promised for Wednesday and a high of 42. Clear skies Wednesday night and a low of 21. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking about Libya today, what's going on there. We just concluded a conversation with Hassan Ali, OSU economics professor in Cairo right now. Joining us now is Central Ohio businessman Hamdi Salomon. He's organizing area supporters in solidarity with protesters in Libya trying to overthrow the Gaddafi regime. Welcome to the show, Hamdi.
Thank you, Anne. Good to be here.
Also with us is Heba Benamran. She is a local educator. She just returned, she returned this fall from a visit to Libya, which is her birthplace. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Now, Hamdi, you just returned from a trip to Libya. You left there when you were a teenager to attend high school, to go to school in the United States. You were away for about 28 years, and you started going back in 2008.
Yes, I went back in 2008, and then 2009, and I just came back from Libya on January 30th, you know, with everything that's been going on. So
you left because of the turmoil?
No, when I left, things are just happening in Egypt. You know, Mubarak was on the verge of coming down, you know, and the people in Libya, they were just looking at Egypt, and they're hoping, you know, Libya might be next, you know. But because there's so much fear in the Libyan people's heart, Gaddafi has forced them and placed fear in their heart for 42 years. They were just sitting there and dreaming, kind of like a kid, you know, looking at a candy shop from the window and just strolling and dreaming, wonder if that's going to be us next.
So what was the tipping point? Was it Egypt, the success in Egypt, or was it something else?
Well, you know, before Tunisia, before Tunis happened, you know, a lot of the, you know, it was a dream for all of us in the outside of Libya and even the people in Libya. Someday, you know, I remember my dad used to say, God rest his soul, I wonder wonder if we're going to live to see him overthrown. You know, so a lot of generation have passed, you know, hoping for Gaddafi to go. So what happened in Tunis, then what happened in Egypt, that gave people's hope. You know, they gave people's hope, and then you know, as you know, Gaddafi has killed in one day has killed about 1,200 people in one of the Muslim prisons,
right.
and so people were active against that once a week every Saturday, and then the arrest of their spokesman, the lawyer that day, that kind of ignited that. But the Libyan population were planning for a general protest on February 17th.
Anyway,
mm-hmm. And that kind of just hell speeded it up, you know. And then they just had so much fear in their heart. But like I said, when God has lifted that fear, you know, you can't stop the power of the people.
I heard an older gentleman on BBC this morning, a Libyan gentleman, talking about thanking the youth, that if it wasn't for particularly the young men protesting, that this wouldn't be happening, that it's very much of a youthful movement, which it was in Egypt.
Yes, definitely. I do believe so. The youth, they just, you know, just full of strength and ability to be able to take this to the level that it's taken. And, I mean, they've done a remarkable job. You know, unfortunately, we have seen a lot of deaths in this situation. We don't have confirmed numbers at this time, but basically the deaths have surpassed 2,000. And, you know, just like Professor Ali just mentioned, you know, there were some bodies dumped in the sea. There's a lot of people that are missing and unaccounted for. And that's, you know, probably one of the reasons is that, you know, they are dumped in the sea. They're mass burials. So we don't know what the confirmed death toll is, and we will not know for a while.
I guess I should ask if your friends and family and the people you know back there are safe and sound and what they're telling you.
Well, as far as my family goes, we are from Benghazi. And so, you know, the East, it's pretty much in good hands at this time. My sister-in-law, my dad's cousins, a lot of other friends and family are in Tripoli. And, you know, they're just dealing with this. They're locked up in their houses. They're on lockdown with security personnel, you know, blocking the streets, mercenaries running up and down the streets, making sure that nobody does leave their house. Even food, you know, is really hard to get in Tripoli right now because they are on lockdown.
And Hamdi, what about you?
Yeah, and, you know, like you said, the youth, we're so proud of our Libyan youth over the, you know, over the last few weeks. And you got to understand that Gaddafi has pressed that age for a long time. You know, they weren't allowed to read English. He took English out of the schools. The difference between the Libyan youth and the Egyptian and the Tunisian, they had, you know, they had infrastructure, they had teaching, you know, but in Libya they didn't have none of that. You know, most of that generation, the younger generation, learned English on their own, learned how to get on the internet on their own, learned Facebook on their own. So our heart goes out to them. I mean, they have accomplished a long way, you know. Yeah, my family, all my immediate family is okay, but of course our overall Libyan family we're concerned about, you know. And then, like Hiba said, all of the, most of the East are taken care of, up to Tijdabia on back. Right now is in, you know, our heart is in Tripoli, our effort is in Tripoli. Like Dr. Ali said earlier, you know, people in the United States can't imagine your cell phone, the government would turn the switch on and off and just shut all the cell phones, you know, shut the internet from Tripoli, just one shot and everything is shut off. So when this first started, you know, it was very tough for the Libyan people to get the message out, you know. Mm-hmm. Gaddafi was slaughtering, his militia, his mercenary was slaughtering, and the message was not taken, it was not getting out, you know. So the youth depended on all of us here in the West to get this message out, you know, and put the pressure on the governments. So.
Libya appears to be very closed off from the rest of the world and has for, you know, as long, for most of my lifetime. So I was surprised to hear the youth when they're being, particularly on BBC, that's where I've heard most of the interviewing, mm-hmm. they're very fluent in English. And mm-hmm. I wondered about how they're achieving that.
A lot of that from satellites, a lot of that from, like I said, from the internet, a lot of that is self-taught. Definitely not from the Libyan government, you know, definitely not from the Libyan government.
My guests are Hamdi Salaman. He's a local businessman and organizing protests or I should say demonstrations of solidarity for the Libyan rebels in Columbus. And also Heba Banamran. She is a local educator. She recently returned from Libya. And if you have a question or comment for them, I welcome them. 614-292-8513. or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We had a caller in the previous segment. They couldn't stay on the line, but they wanted to know, how can the U.S. help without being seen as colonizing or the colonists or interfering with the sovereignty of Libyans?
Well, you know, this is a good question because, you know, that was on our mind for a long time, you know, when this whole thing was going on. The United States was not very quick to react, you know. President Obama, two years ago when he was in Cairo, he said he's going to stand behind government that's committed to govern that reflect the will of the people, and he spoke of the common aspiration of all people to live in a peace and security and to get education and work with the integrity and the ability to speak on what's on their mind and basically live like a basic human being, you know. So We were a little bit disappointed with the United States government at first because, you know, they were waiting on which side the scale is going to tip in. You know, the United States, they always knew Gaddafi was a dictator. Gaddafi never changed. Gaddafi's the same madman that bombed the nightclub in Germany, the same madman that did the Lockerbie, the ban M103. He has never changed. But, you know, back in 2003 when Gaddafi decided George Bush wanted somebody on his side to surrender the weapon of mass destruction, you know, they looked for Gaddafi, denounce terrorism and give up the paperwork or your research, and then in return Gaddafi could do whatever he wanted to do in Libya. So Gaddafi is still the same madman, you know, has not changed. So what the United States were in the last few days, you know, they have come to the table, you know, we're very thankful for that. We're not necessarily for looking for outside force. We just want to even the scale. Gaddafi has, you know, this is a regime that's been there for 42 years. So he has infrastructure, he has power, he has money, he has, and the Libyan people, especially on the east, they don't have a lot of stuff, you know. The army in the east, they have weapon, but they don't have no ammunition. If you could understand that, you know. So whatever it takes, the first thing we're pushing for right now is the no-fly zone. You know, that way, because there's a lot of people who want to go from the east to help the west, but you know, it's between Benghazi and Tripoli is about 1,000 kilometers, mm-hmm. about 800 miles. So people are afraid that they're going to get showered by airplanes, you know, and so forth. So we're looking for the no-fly zone, and then hopefully Gaddafi will see that as a threat, you know, when he have the United States aircraft, you know, sitting right across from him, you know, hopefully that would deter him. He's not going to go anywhere, like Dr. Hassan said. He's going to stay in Libya, and he's going to die in Libya, and then actually the Libyan people would welcome that, you know.
What about American involvement? What have you heard from people about that?
Speaking personally with the Libyans in Libya, mm-hmm. they do not want American involvement. They don't want military to come in, and they definitely don't want to be in a situation like Iraq. Mm-hmm. They just are pleading for a no-fly zone because, you know, the main reason is Gaddafi continues to fly in mercenaries, and we're talking thousands.
And why does he need to bring in mercenaries? He has an army. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, no, you're fine. Yeah. There's a trust issue with him. You can only trust someone for so long. And when, you know, as we've seen in the East, people were turning against him, his own people were turning against him. And so with mercenaries, you know, you just pay them a little bit of money, they come in, and their main target is to kill the people, and there's no repercussions on their end. Whereas the Libyans, we're seeing less of this in Tripoli, but they're having this guilty feeling where they don't want to turn on their own people. And so, you know, and that's where I said there's a trust issue. He feels that his own people are going to end up turning against him, which is what we want. But with the mercenaries, we don't see that. You know, their number one goal is to kill the Libyan people, especially the anti-Gaddafi regime. And so, therefore, he just keeps on flying them in.
Where are most of the mercenaries coming from? Do they know?
From Africa, from Chad, from Niger, from, you know, most of the African, because Gaddafi has spent a lot of money in Africa. They call him the king of Africa, you know. And then the best way to describe it, if you could follow me, there's like there's two militaries in Libya. There's the general military that they just really don't have no ammunition and a lot of.
He keeps them very underarmed.
Exactly. And then there is the close military, the mercenary, his bodyguard, his close militia, that they have all the power and all the force. So, that's why we're looking for the no-fly zone. Eventually, if that doesn't work, maybe we're looking for, like General John McCain said in Cairo Sunday, you know, we should arm the Libyan people, you know, and that might be one of the things that we would welcome to the no-fly zone.
Do you worry, though, when you talk about American arming anybody, that it little by little it's a creeper effect? Like Vietnam, for instance. I mean, you arm them, but then you have to train them to how to use the arms. Really, it's a citizen militia at this point. They're not trained.
Well, it's not necessarily America, but basically the world, because you're fighting, you know, this is a humanity, this is injustice that's going on in Libya. You're watching people being killed, just innocent people, for just basically want to live as a human being, for the basic rights, and then to be on the side of freedom, to be on the side of democracy, and then you start rounding those words and not react to them, then really we're kind of cheating ourselves here in the West, you know.
Why has he kept the military so – the larger military, that – not the people close to him. Why has he kept it so weak?
Because of the trust issue, like Heba said, because if they had all the power, if they had all the ammunition, they would have overthrown him.
A military coup.
Yeah,
correct. He doesn't want what happened – what he did to happen to him.
Okay.
The way that he took over in 1969 obviously was a military coup, and he doesn't want that to happen to him. So, you know, in turn, keeping everybody weak except for him and the immediates around him.
A few years ago, one of the generals walked in on Gaddafi's office and, you know, for an assassination attempt, and he did not succeed. So from that point on, everybody that walks into Gaddafi has to undress and unkeep their arms outside, basically, you know. And so he's very well protected. I mean, remember, this is the guy that have everybody in the world chasing their tails, you know. So he's, like you said earlier, he's a crazy like a fox.
We're going to take a break right now. I just checked the clock. So we'll be right back with my guest, Hamdi Salaman. He's a local businessman, and he has been organizing demonstrations of solidarity with the Libyan rebels in Columbus. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. And also, Heba Banamran, she is a local educator, recently returned from Libya. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
You know the famous cover photo on the 1963 album, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, showing Dylan walking arm-in-arm with a woman down a Greenwich Village street? That woman, Suze Rodolo, was Dylan's girlfriend at the time. She's died at the age of 67. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to the interview I recorded with her in 2008. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. And for as little as $60 per year, you can support 89.7 NPR News and get some great benefits, too. With a basic membership, you'll receive the WOSU member card, good for discounts at more than 200 area restaurants and attractions. You'll also receive a complimentary one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine, and you will automatically receive our electronic airfare program guide and our e-newsletter. To support the programs you love, sign up for a basic membership today. Visit WOSU.org and click Donate Now.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment consultants helping clients achieve financial independence through professional planning at sherringtongroup.com.
Sunshine today and a high of 45 degrees. Clear skies tonight, a low of 29. Sunny skies for Wednesday and a high of 42. And sunshine also as we look ahead to Thursday with a high of 45. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Libya right now. My guests are Hamdi Salaman. He is a local businessman in Central Ohio. He's been working to organize demonstrations of solidarity with the rebels in Libya. And also Heba Banamran, she is a local educator. She visited Libya this year and returned last fall. We want to talk about their experiences. We want to hear from you. If you have any questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or you could email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, we talked a little bit earlier about how Muammar Gaddafi kept the military weak to avoid the kind of military coup that he was successful at 42 years ago. What else has he done to the population in Libya to keep them subdued for so long?
A lot of it, you know, he started Libya turned into a socialist government. So basically, you know, I'm just going to go through them real quick. If you own property, if you own more than one house and one building, they took it away. You only need one house, and the rest, you know, went to the people that lived in them. If he changed the currency about four or five times, where you have 1 week, everybody had 1 week because people did not trust the banks. So he had people had one week to change all that money, and then you had to bring all your money, keep it in the bank, and you only take 10% of what you brought, you know. So a lot of people got devastated that way. Then in a lot of the cities, and especially the city of Tobruk, they didn't have no running water. You know, the water plant broke, so they did not want to fix it, because during the sanction, Gaddafi was telling people we should not have to obey to the West and order the parts from the West. So we're gonna strive and we're gonna fight this out. So people were bussing the water by trucks, you know, and just the basic needs. And he had them kind of going, you know, just so when you get up in the morning, the last thing you worry about is changing the revolution. You have to, or changing the government. You have to go worry where your bread is going to come from, where your food is going to come from, how you're going to feed your family. Teachers, government workers, they would work for weeks and months without a paycheck, you know. So people had to get up. You know, you're an educator, but you can't go to work, or you have to go to work and you're not going to feed your family because you have no money. So you have to go find other ways. You have to go and sell stuff.
And yet all of that in a country of such wealth.
Yeah. Correct. Hamdi just touched on the fact that, you know, people went on months without receiving a salary. Let me just give you an idea of some salaries in Libya. Mind you, again, it is an oil country. It's very rich. Yet a teacher makes $200 a month. Some doctors make $500 a month. And that is considered a really good salary. And yes, cost of living is not that much compared to living in the U.S., but $200 a month doesn't do much. You know, I lived there for about a year. I went to go visit just to kind of experience what life was like there. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see firsthand. I didn't want to just know what life was like there based on other people's experiences. I wanted to see it for myself. And my monthly spending was more than $400 a month. And so if
you
I was
like a queen then, right?
Correct. And so to try and make ends meet on $200 a month, that's just almost impossible. So, I mean, that was, you know, just to give you an idea of what the salaries are like there. You know, the one good thing that I did see was that there's a lot of Western companies, a lot of foreign companies, you know, making Libya as, you know, a home. And, you know, there was a lot of infrastructure, a lot of new buildings and reconstruction of buildings and just general infrastructure with, like, the sewer system and things like that. But that really is not a big deal when you look at the big picture.
And Gaddafi, or, you know, like you said, the interview that you watched and on BBC, where Gaddafi said, "My people love me. There's mm-hmm. no demonstration outside." And then the West does not understand my government. Well, he's correct. You know, I'll give him that. The West does not understand his government because they don't understand how could a rich country be like Libya. People are striving and can't find anything to eat. How can you rule people and depress their freedom? How can you just force them? You know, you could be walking in the street and you always got to watch over your soldier because they could come and take you from your house and nobody would know where you're at. You know, you can't, you know, He implanted a lot of the fear between the people. He disrupted the families. You know, he made people are so paranoid to talk about. You know, you can't talk about the regime. You can't talk about the government. You know, because you don't know who's the informant, who's not. You know, because he placed the hardship in front of all the people in the people's hearts. So that's why the West does not understand his regime.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Tom from Circleville, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on. I want to say that my prayers and everything go out to the people of Libya. I support them in any way I can. But the United States can no longer be the policeman of the world. There are many good countries around Libya that could give them financial or military support. Every time a crisis happens in the world, the first people they come to is the United States. And then after we get in there, and then we are vilified, you know, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thanks, Tom.
Okay. Thank you, Tom, for your prayer and your concern about the Libyan people. We appreciate that. Yeah. The United States, we look to the United States because, the United States is the leader of the world. The Libyan people are not looking for a handout. Like we said, Libya is a very wealthy country. But up till now, that wealth is in the wrong hand. And then, God willing, when Libya come to be free, then Libya is going to contribute a lot more to the world. You know, that's how Libya was during the kingdom, and that's how we foresee it. You know, you got to understand a lot of the countries around Libya, they're all made of those regimes. You know, they're all made of the same thing. You know, so they're not going to talk against Gaddafi because they're the same government, whether in Saudi, whether in Jordan, whether so they're not. You know, and President, you know, the United States is encouraging freedom everywhere. If we're the advocate of democracy, we're encouraging democracy, that's the price we have to pay. You know, you don't want to be the policeman of the world, but, you know, you're kind of wearing that hat. I hope that answered the question. Eva?
We had a caller in earlier, and they had to go. They asked, there are about 1.5 million Libyan professionals, doctors, et cetera, throughout the world. Will they return to Libya and help rebuild it?
I do believe so. I think everyone is already just kind of like, you know, standing aside, you know, bags packed, ready to go, ready to help, ready to do whatever they can to help Libya. You know, a lot of people have left Libya to educate themselves better and gain experience, knowledge, anything that they can do to better help Libya once the day comes where Gaddafi is no longer there. And, you know, there's already been convoys of Libyan doctors heading to Libya to try and help as much as they can, you know, because as you know, there's a shortage of that in the east where they're able to get in. So, yes, everyone is ready to head back to help the country as much as they can.
Hamdi?
Yeah, and kind of coincide with Hiba on that. There's a lot of educated people outside that they're willing to go back. You know, Libya is not it's the population is about 6.5 million people, and it's about the size of Alaska. So, so it's a smaller country, yet it has a lot of resources. It has a lot of and could contribute a lot to the world. You know, if it's a free country. You know, so it's in the best interest of everybody to help. You know, because, you know, nothing else will be in Libya, or nothing, or the Libyan people will not allow any other government but a democratic government in Libya, that all the voices are heard, and real similar to probably what's going on in Turkey, you know, where you have the democracy and so forth.
Will Libyans there who have stayed there and suffered over the years, are they going to welcome back the Libyans who left?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. And, you know, they are relying on our education and our experience to come and train them as well. That's not to say that they're not experienced and trained. You know, there's a lot of intelligent people in Libya. There's a lot. But they will definitely be open to anything that is given to them. And that's basically in our hands to take what we have learned back to Libya and train them and try and make it a better country.
It's surprising when you think of how much control he enforced over the people there that you could come and go like you did. And Hamdi, you've been back a couple times since 2008. They weren't concerned about someone like you, Heba, being there and influencing?
Well, because, you know, since the return of the relationship with the United States government, you know, Gaddafi, they tried everything in their power to be accepted by the West, and especially his son. So they weren't going to jeopardize, you know, that's one of the big things that they did. They opened the borders. They opened, you know, the doors for people to come to show to the world, you know, that, you know, you could come in here anytime. And his son, Saif al-Islam, he was the perfect picture. He represented himself to the West, you know, as he's the one that Western educated. But now you see his true colors coming out. Yesterday he had a machine gun on the top of a tank in Libya and threatened the Libyan people. people, you know. So they weren't gonna close the doors on people like us. So we went in just to see, and we only went in after there was an United States embassy in Libya. Before that, we did not dare to go because, you know, we're
American, no protection.
Yeah,
then.
We're an American citizen, and we wanted that, you know, that protection, and but that the protection that most Libyan people do not have, you know. And then, you know, the revolutionary in Libya, it's coming from all across Libya, from all sort of people. It's led by the youth, but it's from all different side of Libya. So a lot of the people from outside that are outside of Libya, they've been educated and keeping themselves abreast of what's going on. They're all going to return to Libya, and they're going to put their hand in hand with the Libyan people, you know, and just whatever it takes to free it and to bring it back to the, you know, to the world as a free country and contributor to the free world, you know, will do that. So.
After he falls, you know, if and when, and you're saying that, as everyone's saying, he will die there. Now that he's killed so many of his own people, he's gone beyond the pale now, and it's inevitable. But there's the interim period where other people can rush in and other forces can rush in and elements and that kind of a thing. Is that a concern in Libya at this point, like it was in Egypt, like it is anywhere where one government's falling and another has not yet formed?
Exactly. That concern is going to be, you know, anywhere. But from what we understand and what we've heard from family and friends, at least in the eastern portion, they have done a pretty good job with keeping things under control. They formed committees. Everyone's lending a helping hand. You know, based on my friends and family that I've spoken to, they said they have never, ever seen the East so beautiful and everyone working together the way they are. You know, one of my friends quoted, even if two people hate each other, they love each other now. They see each other. They hug each other. They, you know, say hello to each other. They help each other. And we've never had that experience before. And they said it's just an amazing sight to see. And so everyone is coming together, working together. So I don't think at this time there is much of a concern of any particular group kind of taking over. Everyone's just working together right now.
Exactly. And then you got to understand that, you know, nobody wants a government that's not going to work. You know, people are working in Libya, you know, unlike not to bring down the Egyptian or the Tunisian, but you haven't heard of any looting in Libya. You know, people are focused on the revolution because you got to understand, 42 years, in the longest government that's been there in power, you know, people have lived with that for 42 years. They did not think this moment is possible. They had no idea they're going to live through it, you know. And now that it's come to them, God brought this moment to them. It's unbelievable. I mean, you can't express it in words.
And some folks are saying, well, there were only six plus million people there, and that was a little bit of a disadvantage when you wanted to do the million man marches and that kind of a thing, because it was just statistically, you know, not the same odds. But how much of an advantage is that in coalescing the country and bringing the country together and unifying it, because it is so much smaller, although they are spread across a wide area?
And I know they've been talking about Libya as a tribal country, which is true, but, yeah, you know, a lot of those tribes are married into each other, you know, so people are, they know each other in this country, you know, they know, you know, where each person come from, your background and so forth. So it's a good advantage to have, you know, and then, like I said, in the East, you know, a lot of people have been out and contributed and demonstrated against Gaddafi, and then they're willing to go to the West. But like I said earlier, they're afraid of the airplane, and like we heard yesterday in the news, some Libyan jet flights, you know, airplanes, they went in and bombed one of the military bases on the east side of Libya. So
we have an email from Kelly. Despite being a dictatorship, is Libya religiously intensive, or is it more secular and pluralistic?
I definitely don't think it's very religious. Like we've heard fears coming out of Egypt saying that, you know, once Hosni Mubarak fell, there was a fear of the Brotherhood taking
Muslim
over.
Brotherhood,
correct.
Right.
We don't have that in Libya.
That's
have that at all in Libya.
I mean, there's no doubt that Islam is the faith and the culture of Libya and runs through all of us. You know, we're Muslims. We pray to God. We pray five times a day. But, you know, that's not the kind of government we're looking for. You know, I mean, the Libyan people, we're not an Islamist state, or, you know, regardless of what a lot of people are saying in the media, Libya is going to turn into an Islamist state. It's going to be like Iran. It's going to be, you know, mm-hmm. We don't see the Libyan people that way. Like I said, we're religious. We practice, you know, but we also like to have our freedom, you know. And do the right thing.
What about, you said it's pretty monolithic then. There's not a lot of ethnic strife. The only differences might be the different tribes at this point.
Exactly, yeah.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We just have a few more minutes with our guests. How about Ben Namran and also Hamdi Salomon, if you have a question or comment. I want to talk to you, Hamdi, about what you're doing locally to organize the demonstrations of support.
We have been demonstrating here in a couple of spots in front of the Lenox Center here in Columbus, you know, because there's a lot of Libyan people in Columbus.
Tell us about how many Libyan people.
There's over probably about 350 people that are Libyan. You know, some of them are students, some of them are, have lived here for a long time like us, you know. So they feel they have to contribute, you know, and then and we want to let our brothers and sisters in Libya that we're standing here, you know, with them hand in hand and trying to bring the solidarity. You know, some of the things we're trying to collect, medical supplies, things that we could send to Libya, satellite phones, because like I said, Gaddafi could shut the phone. So we have been collecting a lot of money from Libyans and non-Libyan and buying those supplies, the medical supplies. There has been some companies that have donated those supplies. So there's a lot of effort because, like I said, even though it's Libya is a wealthy country, but everything's under Gaddafi's regime, everything's under his hand, and then the hospitals, you know, they don't have nothing, you know, the schools, the food, there's a lot of shortages on a lot of stuff right now.
Yeah, during the first couple of days, if you don't mind me interrupting, of the revolution, the hospitals were running out of blood supply. They were running out of medical supply. And so right now there are a couple organizations working on getting envoys into, more specifically, the east through the Egyptian border. One of the organizations is called Muslims Without Borders, and that is they've set up a hub in Alexandria, Egypt, and they're importing in medical supplies and the major necessities through the Egyptian-Libyan border.
So if somebody's out there and wants to help, Muslims Without Borders is one way they could do it.
Correct. The one website that we have been using is libyafeb17.com.
Could you spell that?
LibyaFeb17, the number 17.com. And that we have a link on that website that is direct with Muslims Without Borders, and that's specific for the Libyan cause.
So that's Libya February 17th. That's what that stands for?
Correct.
Libya Feb 17. I love it when I can break codes like that. I want to thank you for joining us today and sharing your stories and your insights. Hamdi Salomon, he's a local businessman. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Anne, so much for listening to us.
And also Heba Banamran, a local teacher. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Anne, for having us.
That's all the time we have. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.